Salt Lake Sunstone Symposium presents session 237, a panel discussion on the LDS Church's political opposition to same-sex marriage.
And here, this session, as you're probably aware, was not in the preliminary program. It has been added more recently because of unfolding events in the press and otherwise, as I would assume. Two days ago, I learned that this session was going to be given. Yesterday, I learned that I would be chairing this session. And I think the panel members have similarly been on a short timeline to get this put together. Those of you who've been here the last couple of days are aware that we have done a number of sessions which have been rather introspective about Sunstone and its mission and its purpose, its experience over 25 years. And it seemed to me that this might be an appropriate time to just touch very briefly on that theme of the mission of Sunstone. And I would call your attention to the cover of your permanent program for the symposium, where the statement is reprinted. It has been reprinted in Sunstone programs for years now. I think it dates back to the Peggy Fletcher era. And it's always, this statement is something that I have always gravitated toward when I've been criticized in one way or another for participating in Sunstone. Because I really believe that this statement is an accurate and worthwhile statement of why we are here. This symposium is dedicated to the idea that the truths of the gospel of Jesus Christ are better understood and as a result better lived when they are freely and frankly explored within the community of the saints. We recognize that the search for things that are, have been, and are to be is a sifting process in which much chaff will have to be inspected and threshed before wheat can be harvested. In sponsoring this symposium, we welcome the honest ponderings of Latter-day Saints and their friends and expect that everyone will approach all issues, no matter how difficult, with intelligence and goodwill. That would be my invocation for our demeanor in this session. I attended a session earlier this morning where two of our very distinguished Sunstone mentors and contributors over the years, Ed Kimball and Armand Moss, talked about how we accomplish this purpose. And they both gently reminded us that for many reasons, Sunstone is, and the symposium, is a marketplace of ideas, and that should be almost unfettered. When you get into the advocacy of action, however, you have a different mix and possibly different issues. We're here today to talk about some ideas, some developments, some history. We're probably going to talk about some policies and some moral issues. And I believe that the statement about intelligence and goodwill is very important to this discussion, as these things develop in the press and otherwise. We are fortunate to have three panelists who are going to talk about various aspects of this development, of the church's involvement in a California political campaign. I'm going to introduce them in the order that they will speak. This is an hour and a half session, and I've encouraged the panelists to, even though there's a lot of material to cover here, to be as brief as possible, and hopefully there will be time to share discussion and questions with you in the audience. Our first speaker, who is sitting in the middle, is J. Allen Blodgett from Portland, Oregon. Allen holds a BA and a master's degree in business from BYU. He is a former managing director of the financial department of the LDS Church. In recent years, just this spring, in fact, he retired as a financial officer, chief financial officer for an equipment manufacturing company in Portland, and is a longtime attender and contributor at Sunstone. Our second speaker on the far end of the table is Roger Leishman. Roger has presented at Sunstone before a couple of years ago. He updated us on what was going on in Hawaii, in particular, with the gay marriage issue. Roger earned his bachelor's degree at BYU and his Juris Doctor from Yale. He is currently the director of the Gay and Lesbian Rights Project of the Illinois ACLU and is based in Chicago. Our third presenter here on my immediate left is Robert J. Christensen, who holds a BA from Yale in the History of Arts and Letters and is currently a graduate student at the University of Oregon in Eugene. I will invite the presenters to come forward then in that order, and they will explain in their own introductions what they're going to cover.
My invitation to the session originally was to read a transcript compiled by David Coombe, and not to really make a statement of my own, but I have concluded to make a statement of my own after reading the transcript. David Coombe is from Ventura, California, and has followed the California initiative very closely and has made a rather detailed transcript that he's asked that I read to you. David is, I believe, employed by the Ventura County Library. On 7 March 2000, the state of California will be holding its primary election as part of the national process to select the next president of the United States. Among the items on the ballot will be an initiative to amend California law to define marriage as being between one man and one woman. The initiative, number 819, is defined definition of marriage on the webpage of the California Secretary of State. The listed proponent is State Senator William J. Pete Knight. The legal summary on the third page of the web document reads as follows. Adds a provision to the Family Code providing that only marriage between a man and a woman is valid or recognized in California. The Family Code definition of marriage currently reads, and this is paragraph 300, marriage is a personal relation arising out of a civil contract between a man and a woman to which the consent of the parties capable of making that contract is necessary. Consent alone does not constitute marriage. Consent must be followed by the issuance of a license and solemnization as authorized by this division. The Family Code also provides a marriage contracted outside the state that would be valid by the laws of the jurisdiction in which the marriage was contracted is valid in this state. The California Secretary of State faxed to David a copy of the actual initiative as it will appear on the ballot. Initiative measure to be submitted directly to the voters. Section 1. This act may be cited as the California Defense of Marriage Act. Section 2, paragraph 308.5 is added to the Family Code to read, only marriage between a man and woman is valid or recognized in California. Just prior to the 1996 presidential election, President Clinton signed a Defense of Marriage Act, DOMA, which allows states to decide whether to recognize a marriage that was not between one man and one woman. The constitutionality of DOMA is in question, as a court might find this is a violation of Article 4, Section 1 of the U.S. Constitution, which states that full faith and credit shall be given in each state to the public acts, records, and judicial proceedings of every other state. For a court to consider the constitutionality of DOMA, a state would have to recognize some other form of marriage, such as two men, two women, polygamy, and then some test case would have to be arranged. The Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints has been at the forefront among organized groups opposing same-sex marriage. the Mormon Church's efforts in Hawaii, both in organizing and fundraising the supposedly local group opposing same-sex marriage, its efforts legally to be made a party to the court cases there, and its fundraising have been documented elsewhere. The Mormon Church's organizing and fundraising in last year's election in Alaska, including its last-minute donation of $500,000, which was reported to have been spent on media campaigns, has also been documented. The Church Handbook of Instructions, which details church procedures to priesthood leaders and was revised and issued in January 1999, has several paragraphs that seem significant. Quote, "The church normally is exempt from paying sales, property, income, and other taxes because it is a religious organization. Church buildings and other property are to be used for the purposes of worship and religious instruction and other church-related activities. Facilities are not to be used for political, business, or investment purposes. If one stake or ward misuses the church's tax-exempt status, other church units could be affected. The church is politically neutral. It does not endorse political parties, platforms, or candidates. Church leaders and members should avoid any statements or conduct that might be interpreted as a church endorsement of a political party or candidate. Church facilities may not be used for political purposes except for voter registration. Members should do their civic duty by supporting measures that strengthen society morally, economically, and culturally. Members are encouraged to be actively engaged in worthy causes to improve their communities and make them wholesome places in which to live and rear families. However, members should not give the impression that they represent the church as they work for solutions to city or community problems." End of quote. Following the pattern of Hawaii and Alaska, the church has begun its involvement in the California March 2000 election. A letter dated May 11th of this year was signed by John B. Dixon, John M. Madsen, and Cecil O. Samuelson, general authorities of the church, who constitute the area presidency of the North America West area, which was addressed to all priesthood leaders in California. Recipients were directed to read the letter to Melchizedek Priesthood Quorums and Relief Society on either May 23rd or May 30th. The letter describes the initiative, quotes from the First Presidency on the importance of marriage, defines the initiative as a moral issue, and urges church members to give their support. The letter also states that a broad-based coalition is being formed to work for the passage of the traditional marriage initiative, and that details will be forwarded to the recipients as they become available. With the letter are enclosures, including questions and answers on the initiative, as well as political commentary. The full text of the letter, as well as the text of the enclosures, began to appear on the Mormon Internet list in early June. June 9th, an internet posting from a priesthood leader began circulating on California email list. He described a priesthood leadership meeting in which a member of the stake presidency told the assembled group that the stake would be receiving an assessment to raise money to support the initiative, and that members would be asked to support this by contributing directly to an unidentified organization, which is not a PAC, and that the contributions are not tax deductible. The money would not go through church accounts. June 11th, a person living in San Francisco Bay Area reported on a public Mormon email list that a friend told her by email that the stakes and wards have been assessed rather large amounts to raise for the anti-gay initiative in California. Members are being called in by their bishops and asked to donate substantial sums above tithing and send it directly to the organization that is sponsoring the legislation. May 13, a friend of mine called his state president and point blank asked him if the reports on the internet were true. The state president flatly denied it. June 14, a second confirmation from the San Francisco Bay Area was sent to a public internet list. A bishop reported, "The state presidents have been asked to raise specific dollar amounts. It is not supposed to be done officially. It is to be done by contacting individuals directly. The state president is doing it himself. The state president specifically told the bishops that a person not contributing was still eligible for a temple recommend." June 14. A person reported on email that while the letter read in the meetings came from the area presidency, the directive about money came to her state president through the area authority 70 and not directly from the area presidency. Area authority 70s, according to the Church Handbook of Instructions, serve under the direction of the Quorum of the Twelve, the presidents of the 70, and the area presidency where they are assigned. And they fulfill several assignments as needed. On June 16th, the friend who inquired of the state president, as noted above, was called on the phone by the state president. He told my friend that he had attended a meeting that evening and that he had been given an assignment and was calling to correct the information he had given my friend on the previous Sunday. June 18, a friend called Cecil Samuelson, a counselor in the area presidency of the North America West area and one of the signers of the May 11th letter, Elder Samuelson said that my friend could feel comfortable understanding the letter as official church policy. The letter's purpose was to urge church members to support a coalition that drew together many different religions and non-religious groups. The coalition could be reached by in Sacramento by calling Robert Stutzman. Elder Samuelson stated no specific contributions amounts were being sought at any level of the church organization, but the people were being encouraged and things were being done locally, so he could not speak for specific local actions. He said the church looked at this as a moral issue and that the doctrine of the church was very clear. And a call to the number given by Elder Samuelson indicated that the organization is named the Protection of Marriage Committee, which is located in Sacramento. And I'll have handouts if you want the numbers and addresses of these organizations. Parenthetically, an article appeared in the San Francisco Examiner, dated 5 May, reported that Mike Marshall is the campaign manager of Californians for Fairness, which opposes the initiative, and the handout will have that address and telephone numbers if anyone is interested. A California church member reported on the Mormon Internet list on 21st of June that the day before Sunday, the 20th, that at the meeting of the Sunday school, he and several ward members were invited by a counselor in the bishopric to visit during Sunday school with the bishop in his office. The bishop asked them about the fundraising, or talked to them about the fundraising campaign. The bishop told them that gay activists were prepared to spend $10 million to defeat the initiative and that it needed to pass and protect, was prepared to spend $10 million to defeat the initiative and that it needed to pass and protect the world that their children would live in. He mentioned gay activism in San Francisco area as a problem. The bishop told them, the author of the email post reported, that the fundraising effort was being done with the authority of the area presidency and the first presidency was supportive. The bishopric would provide later the information as to where to send the money, and told the group the money would not be tax deductible. He also told them that there would be no pressure to donate, nor any ecclesiastical repercussions for not donating. The Post further reported the specific dollar amount that was being assessed by the stake, as well as the specific amount that had been assigned to his ward, but to protect his identity, I have not stated these figures. The bishop also told them that he could not say anything about this over the pulpit. The bishop stated that Salt Lake, presumably church headquarters, wants to make sure this proposition passes, since California sets patterns for the nation, and if California supported same-sex marriage, the rest of the country would follow. The bishop told the group in his office that this was the right thing to do, since it was in accordance with the proclamation on the family. A woman reported on an email post about a conversation with a friend on Monday, June 21st, about what happened in her friend's ward. The bishop made a presentation on the initiative in Relief Society. After the bishop left, two women in the group made public comment expressing concern about the church interfering with their right to decide the issue and vote freely. A third woman, a visitor in the ward, also described the private meetings the leaders were having with church members to request donations. At the close of the meeting, the Relief Society president defended the initiative as a moral issue, as well as the methods the church is using to support it financially. A priesthood quorum leader reported in a post on June 22nd that the request for financial contributions to support passage of the initiative was on the agenda for next Sunday's meeting of the bishop and other leaders of organizations for the adults in his ward. One person in an internet message reported that his stake president had discussed the letter of May 11th with Elder Neil A. Maxwell of the Quorum of the Twelve Apostles, who reportedly confirmed to the stake president that the letter was to be read. Elder Maxwell said these things were done with his approval. June 24th, a priesthood leader in Greater Los Angeles reports that his ward had been given an assessment of $10,000. He also reported that the stake president told the bishops that the decision to become involved had come directly from President Gordon B. Hinckley. A poster on the internet on June 27th reported that the priesthood meeting he attended in San Diego County that day was used to explain that the church had authorized members to support the Knight Initiative. June 28th, a post described a conversation with a relative who was a bishop in California. He reported that the bishop said the goal for funds to be raised from the stake required an average donation of $250 from each family, with the better off being asked to donate more and the less well off less. July 3rd. The July 3rd issue of the Los Angeles Times features an article by Larry Stammer, a LA Times religion writer, titled No End to Dissent. The article describes the battle over rights for gays and lesbians in several religious denominations. Stammer identifies as backers of the Knight Initiative the California Conference of Catholic Bishops, the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, sometimes called the Mormons, the Assemblies of God, and the Assemblies of God Northern California, Nevada District. Elder Douglas C. Callister, who is not otherwise identified, but is the Area 70 of the Mormon Church, was interviewed. Stammer writes, ask about the Mormon Church's support of the March ballot measure against recognizing same-sex marriage. Elder Douglas C. Callister said that traditional marriage between a man and woman is at stake. It's whether or not marriage means anything at all, Callister said. This is very painful for us. We do not get involved in these issues unless we think it is a moral issue, not a political issue. We are not anti-gay. We have many fine friends that are in the gay community and do not wish to be their adversaries. But our concern is the thing we believe we are defending, traditional marriage. This is a moral issue, and we wish we did not live in a society in which we felt it was being attacked. July 4th, San Francisco Examiner's front page headlines reads, Mormons now target California. Church asks members to back state ballot initiative. Reporter Robert Saladay writes about the church activity in California, comparing it to the efforts in Hawaii and Alaska. Saladay writes, the letter was authorized at the highest reaches of the Mormon Church and should be considered as inspired and coming from the Lord, said church spokesman Don Raskin in Utah. Yes, a statement from the First Presidency, we believe, is inspired and comes from the Lord, says Raskin. But it's up to the members as to how they respond. This is the direction that is coming from the church, but they still have the option. Nobody is going to be disciplined. A church member in Central California, July 5th, reports that members in his area received letters in the mail with previously addressed and stamped return envelopes enclosed over the signature of a member of the state presidency. He was asked to donate $150, and one other friend who he specifically asked was also received the identical letter with a request to donate $150. Both the San Francisco Chronicle and the San Francisco Examiner in their 7 July editions report that Mark Leno, a San Francisco supervisor, asked both local and state officials to investigate ending the Mormon Church's tax-exempt status following Sunday's article in the Examiner detailing church activities supporting the Knight Initiative. He asked City Attorney Louis Rennie and State Attorney General Bill Lockyer to look into the issue. The article in the Chronicle noted that repeated calls to Mormon headquarters in Salt Lake City were not returned on Tuesday. An email from Kathy Worthington notes on July 8th that 5 people have contacted her with a commitment to, because of the church's political actions in California, begin the process of having their names removed from the membership rolls of the Mormon Church. July 10th, the LA Times prints 3 letters to the editor in response to the article printed on July 3rd. No end to dissent. All 3 letters appear to support marriage between 2 members of the same sex. Mormon humorist Robert Kirby, a writer for the Salt Lake Tribune, on July 10th writes a column satirizing the media response to the Mormon position on same-sex marriage. The Deseret News in Salt Lake City prints an article on July 10th reporting that 2 BYU professors at the Mormon Church-owned and operated university law school described the potential legal challenge in the San Francisco as an attempt to block the influence of religion in public life. Regrettably, some gay and lesbian activists are very vindictive and play a mean brand of hardball. If anyone opposes their political agenda, they go out to punish them. The same article described a news conference called by the Gay and Lesbian Political Action Committee, which asked the church to get out of the political arena. July 11th, on KGOAM Talk Radio, Bernie Ward's weekly program, God Talk, it was almost completely on the topic of Mormon Church's fundraising efforts in California. Several Mormon email posters reported on the program and the calls to Bernie Ward or their attempts to call. July 11th, Salt Lake Tribune has a guest editorial written by Philip de Rocambeau, a columnist for Whosoever, an online magazine for gay and lesbian Christians. He first views the current situation in California with the Mormon Church's position on the Knight Initiative. He argues that marriage is now in the domain of governments and not churches, a change occurring as churches cease to control governments. While churches may facilitate weddings, the role of religion in marriage is now meaningless without the sanction of the state. He uses legal arguments based on the 14th Amendment and the U.S. Supreme Court decisions in Romer versus Evans. The San Francisco Chronicle printed a letter on July 11th about the articles printed earlier in the paper describing the Mormon Church as trying to transform their private prejudices and religious beliefs into the law of the land. And Dave summarizes this by saying, "These are admittedly scattered reports and conclusions are difficult and speculative. I have made a deliberate attempt to be factual in my descriptions of events and to avoid editorial comment of my own." And he prepared this document on July 12th. Since then, there have been two specific items that should be noted. On July 14th, there was an editorial in Deseret News that responded to the San Francisco condemning article, and I believe Robert will refer to the content of that that editorial. And then on yesterday, the 15th, there was an article in the Los Angeles Times defending the church's position and criticizing those who are challenging the church. I hadn't intended to make a statement, but after watching what's going on, I felt like that perhaps I should, because I have rather strong views on this issue. So now let me take just a few minutes to speak for myself. Alan Blodgett, as was mentioned, I live in Portland, Oregon, and have been participating in Sunstone activities since 1985, as I recall. And again, this is my opinion. I speak solely for myself here. I believe the action the church is taking to support the California Knight Initiative is most unfortunate. Already a breach exists between the church and its gay and lesbian members. The intervention by the church in the California Initiative serves to drive the wedge deeper. The gay and lesbian community feels the church is attacking them. They are angry, they are hurt, and they are disappointed, and they are reacting. This group in Utah and elsewhere make it clear that it is not the church they are reacting against, for many hold the church to be dear, but it is the leadership of the church who they feel are insensitive and uncaring with respect to gay and lesbian issues. Gay and lesbians are children of God. They need and often want the gospel of Jesus Christ in their lives. They suffer, and their families suffer, when they are denied fellowship in the church that is important to them. The church also loses when it is left without the talent, service, and commitment of its gay and lesbian members. "Jesus wants me for a sunbeam," we are taught. "Please let me be a sunbeam for him," they ask. As gay and lesbians view it, the current church policy with respect to gay and lesbian members allows only two options. For most, these options are unrealistic and deny any hope of happiness and fellowship in the church. Celibacy is the counsel generally usually given, but which denies the basic need for companionship and deprives gay and lesbian Mormons the most precious of human experiences, to love and be loved by another person. The second option is to enter into a traditional marriage, even though both spouses will be ill-equipped to deal with the stresses and strains of such a relationship. This all too often leads to tragic consequences for not only the gay person, but the special person they choose as a marriage partner. Even the church has come to realize that it should no longer advise gays and lesbians to marry. Among the consequences of the church policy for gay members are: they leave the church, either by choice or by excommunication. They live lives of loneliness, and they despair of ever being with someone they love. They lie, living a double life, outwardly pretending to be Orthodox, but privately yielding to their strong feelings within. On April 8th this year, I was excommunicated by the church because I am living with a man who has been my partner for the past 11 years. I was told that to re-enter the church, it would be necessary to terminate this relationship. This is not a requirement that I can accept. I can assure you the love between two men or between two women can be just as strong as the love between a man and a woman. There is often great commitment and longevity in gay and lesbian relationships. On the way to Salt Lake, Robert and I stayed overnight in the beautiful home of two women who have been together for 36 years. One of my oldest friends in Portland had been a member or had been a partner with his partner for 22 years before his partner's death earlier this year. The move to have same-gender relationships validated by marriage is growing in momentum as the gay and lesbian community becomes more visible and our society becomes more legalistic. Gay and lesbian partners have suffered discrimination and losses that a marriage would have spared them. Many feel their love is just as great as the parties to traditional marriages, and their relationship should be publicly acknowledged and validated. The very use of the word marriage for same-sex unions evokes tremendous opposition and emotion from many people, our church leaders included. It is often suggested that other terms, such as domestic partnerships, might provide the same rights and privileges as a traditional marriage, however allowing the term marriage to be reserved for the union between a man and woman. Many gays and lesbians object to this, however. They claim that no other word or words can convey the depth of their love or the significance of their commitment as the word marriage can. They feel that equality can be had only if their unions can also be sanctioned as marriages. At issue now are the efforts of church leaders to block the move toward the legalization of same-gender marriages. The argument given in support of the church's position on the California initiative, according to Elder Callister, is that traditional marriage between a man and woman is at stake. Is this really true? Those who support same-gender marriages are not challenging traditional marriages. Rather, they recognize the value and importance of marriage and desire the same benefits for themselves. They recognize that a committed, long-term, loving relationship formalized by marriage is better for everyone than the loose, transitory relationships or promiscuity. Another argument is made that individuals will leave traditional marriages to enter into same-gender marriages if they are sanctioned. This argument doesn't hold water. Persons are enticed to leave a failing marriage by the desire to find love with someone who will make them happy, not to obtain a new certificate of marriage. The real problem is the failure of the original marriage. Often it is caused by a gay person marrying a straight person with whom they are not compatible. Usually they try earnestly for years to make the marriage work, particularly if children are involved, but in time the stress has become too great and the marriage is doomed. Leaving a marriage to enter into a same-sex union has always occurred. The opportunity to find a more satisfying relationship is possible for them now, albeit without the certificate to make it official. There will be no real difference should same gender marriages be sanctioned. As an observer of the gay and lesbian community, it is clear the opportunity for same-gender marriages would be a good thing. It would not only enrich the lives of the parties to the marriage, but also benefit society at large. An increasing number of same-sex partners are marrying in their own way, even though their marriages do not have government or church approval. The men and women who make such a commitment are more likely to be spiritually, emotionally, and financially secure than those who do not. They are less likely to suffer from disease, drug use, or the other social ills all too common to a promiscuous lifestyle. the benefits for same-sex partners are no different than for the parties to a traditional marriage. Government recognition of same-gender marriages would result in greater community, family, and hopefully church support of their relationships. It would ensure the same privileges for same-gender marriage partners in property rights and survivor rights in the event of death. Now, a longtime partner cannot be assured the right of being with his or her loved one in the event of a serious illness if the family objects. This would change. In other words, same-gender partners could expect the same rights and privileges and benefits that parties to a traditional marriage expect. No more, no less. In conclusion, which I've had to change after talking to Paul, I believe that gay and lesbian members should be extended a hand of fellowship by the church rather than to face a rejection, even if they are in same-sex relationships. If such relationships need to be judged, let it be the Lord's judgment. I also believe a dialogue should begin to find solution to these difficult issues, because I realize they're not easy for anyone, the gay and lesbian community or for the church or others in the community. I further believe that gays and lesbians should relentlessly pursue equal rights, not special rights, but equal rights, wherever discrimination might exist. Thank you.
I've been asked to step back from the recent 2 months' worth of events in California and talk more generally about the issue of marriage law, marriage rights, and the history of how we got to where we are today, and perhaps touch on the relationship between that history and the Mormon agenda and the homosexual agenda, both of which I consider myself somewhat of an expert on. My first introductory question is that needs to be answered is, what is marriage? The answer to that is, marriage is a legal status recognizing a partnership between individuals. It is a civil status. It's conveyed by each individual state, or in other countries by the country. What it does is it creates a legal shorthand creates legal obligations and legal rights between individuals, two individuals in this country right now. People ask, well, can you find a way around marriage? And there was several years ago, there was a look at the government, at the federal law, and there's something about 4,000 government statutes that refer to the status of marriage. So, for example, if you were to create a partnership between two men, it would take 4,000 interventions to do the job of recognizing the status of marriage. And there are also a lot of things that individually and privately you cannot legally create. So the through marriage, the state creates obligations of support. It creates rights of into property and into companionships that is something that only the state can do. This status, the current civil marriage, is very different from religious marriage. I mean, marriage is a sacrament in many churches, including the Mormon Church. Sacraments and who those should be available to. At the ACLU, we're very concerned by any effort for the government, the federal, the state government, to tell a religion how it chooses who to marry and how to perform those marriages. Marriage, as we see it today, has changed in a couple of very important respects. It is now a civil status. Previously, it was a religious status, but hundreds of years ago, as part of a product of Henry VIII's marital squabbles, in our legal tradition, marriage was taken over by the state long ago. The other change that is very significant is what we refer to as traditional marriage is very new. It's something like 40 or 50 years old. The laws that are in place in the state, the idea that we recognize of a marriage of equals that is chosen freely by a man and a woman, that's a very recent legal development. Earlier in the century, not that long ago, marriage was very much more about the rights of a man, a woman, and the children as essentially the property of a man. And the idea of this kind of partnership, which we all recognize as marriage today, is very recent. But it's the status that we're talking about, and the status of whether that should be opened up to people, regardless of the gender of the two individuals involved. The second question I would ask begin to attempt to answer is, what is the gay agenda with respect to marriage today? Why are we even talking about this? I'm a full-time gay rights lawyer for the ACLU, and because of that, I'm part, along with about 20 of my colleagues around the country from the ACLU and other groups, of the roundtable of civil rights lawyers. We get together, we work with each other, we attempt to some extent to coordinate our work. To the extent that there is an agenda, it's sometimes proactive. We talk about what areas of the law need work, where is discrimination occurring. I'm also, through my work, the chairman of the Federation of Statewide Lesbian Gay Political Organizations, not lawyers, but political activists around the country who work out in the political trenches. And so I see through that part of my job the agenda or lack of agenda of what we do. What we do as activists and as leaders in the lesbian gay community is to move forward the concept of true equality, of removing barriers in the law and society through education, through the law, and through other tools to change the way people think, but also to change the structures of society, of civil society, regardless of ultimately what people's religious beliefs are about the morality of sexual acts and sexual relationships. We believe that in a non-religious, civil, pluralistic society that we can take steps to remove barriers to full and equal participation. How did marriage get on our agenda is a complicated and difficult question that no one can really answer. In a shorthand, I can say we certainly did not plan this. As many of you may have seen, that this is not our easiest issue. If we were to talk about what should we as lesbian gay activists do next, we could make a lot more progress in employment discrimination. We can make a lot of progress working with other kinds of things. How do we start talking about marriage in this day and age? And the answer is, in the early 1990s, in Hawaii, in a lawsuit brought by several individuals, there was a challenge made to Hawaii's law, which recognized that only men and women of opposite sex can be married. We'd made this argument before. We'd argued that, well, to not let me marry a man, but to let a woman marry that same man, is gender discrimination. We've made this argument many, many times, and we've lost for 20 years, over and over and over. And many people expected us to lose again in Hawaii. And to our amazement, in 1992, a court actually bought the argument that, you're right, that is sex discrimination. Under Hawaii's constitution, sex discrimination is illegal, and the government has to demonstrate a compelling reason why they should continue this barrier. This was an extraordinary event for our community, for Americans in a lot of other communities, including the Mormon Church, and it put the issue of marriage and what is marriage on the radar screens for everyone. There are two components of marriage legally. There's the question of who can be married And then the follow-up question of once people are married in a particular state, and each state has their own law of who can be married and how a marriage is celebrated, there's a separate law of, okay, when you move to another state, are you still married? And the answer has been for essentially 200 years that for most purposes, if you're married in Nevada or divorced in Nevada, you will be married or divorced in every other state. Otherwise, this wouldn't be one country. There would be a patchwork. So the prospect that one state might allow members of opposite sexes to get married, which hasn't occurred. It hasn't occurred in Hawaii. It may not occur anytime soon. Has led to a lot of changes in the legal landscape. Right now, the Hawaii case is still pending, even though the Hawaii people voted to amend their constitution to permit the legislature to forbid same-sex marriage. It hasn't done that yet, and we're all waiting for the court to say, what does that initiative mean? Tomorrow, the Hawaii Supreme Court could say that the lesbian gay men could be married in Hawaii. There's also a case in Vermont that we brought that was argued in November of last year under Vermont law, challenging its prohibition. We haven't heard from the Vermont Supreme Court, so tomorrow we could hear in Vermont that Vermont will permit members of the opposite sex to marry. This could happen tomorrow. This could happen in 10 years. It could happen in 20 years. Who knows? I'm not making predictions. What I can predict is there has already been and will continue to be an extraordinary backlash against these developments. Utah was the first state to pass a state law that would forbid the recognition of marriages from another state between members of the opposite sex. This was a bill that occurred illegally in the sense that it was procedurally passed so quickly that was extraordinary. In my own state of Illinois, we were, I think, the fifth state to pass one of these. It was an obscure state legislator named Peter Fitzgerald who rode this issue, raised a lot of money. He's now a member of the U.S. Senate. He was able to use the issue of same-sex marriage and defense of marriage to further his career. This has been an extraordinary fundraising device for the Christian Coalition and other groups. So there's a lot of the agenda that's happened there of using gay rights in particular marriage. The federal defense of marriage law, which passed, purports to permit state. It does two things. One thing is it purports to permit states to choose not to recognize other states' marriages if they involve same-sex couples. This hasn't been tested, as Alan suggested. We won't be able to test that legally. There are a lot of questions about whether under the Constitution a state can do that. I happen to be in the camp that says that the states cannot do that, but we'll wait and see. There are thoughtful people on the other side of that. The federal law also says for federal purposes, regardless of what the states do, the federal government will not recognize same-sex marriages from any state, which is extraordinary. This is the first time in 200 years that the United States federal government has legislated the issue of marriage. It has always been left to the states in the past. This is the force of the backlash is demonstrated by such extraordinary events as that. Turning finally to the church's response as part of this backlash, and the church has only been a part of a variety of social institutions which have felt the threat or which have seen this as opportunity to further their own agendas or to raise money or other things. The Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints has been involved from the early part of this backlash. In Hawaii and in Alaska, it was the single largest donor to the ultimately successful electoral campaigns to change those constitutions to block same-sex marriage. Church invested a little over $1 million in the final 6 months of those two campaigns. Many of us think that it was complete waste because the initiatives passed by such wide margins. It's hard to believe that the church's money made that much of a difference, but they spent $1 million and decided that was worth it for them. In closing, and I look forward to welcoming questions about this history. I've sort of like just tried to sketch where we are in this essentially a 7-year cycle of how we got to marriage and how we got to where Hawaii to California. California is very important for a couple of reasons. It's a bellwether state. It's very large. It has a very liberal recognition law. So it's one of those states where if another state were to recognize same-sex marriage, California clearly would accept that. So there are good reasons why State Senator Knight has chosen to put this initiative forward. It's also a populous. It's a leading state. Even though about 27 states have already passed such laws, this has become the next big battleground for essentially a moot point. It's not like marriage is right around the corner, but it really is sort of the front line of this clash of agendas, this clash of cultures and culture wars. My final observation about the situation, and I am not a tax lawyer, a nonprofit lawyer. I know something about it, but not that much. And so I would certainly defer to other people. I know there's talk bandied about the threat to the church's tax exempt status for the things that are going on there. And there really is a threat. It's the sort of threat that perhaps it's not that likely, but it's the sort of situation where what would happen, and the only thing that could happen would be for the church to stop being a religion, similar to what we're seeing in Illinois now with the Church of the Creator and this sort of thing. The tax laws are very clumsy. It's sort of like the all or nothing excommunication thing that any religious organization that gets involved in partisan politics, as the Christian Coalition learned this year, takes a terrible risk of losing their ability to offer tax deduction to donations. It really is an extraordinarily risky route to go down. But who knows what will ultimately happen there? But it's an interesting choice for a religion to choose to do. My final observation is the church has gotten involved in politics outside of Utah, where obviously the church is very involved in politics all the time. But the church has gotten involved in the broader political realm on very few occasions in the last 20, 25 years on the MX missiles and other things like that. What is interesting about this situation in California is what it most closely resembles was the church's role in defeating the Equal Rights Amendment 20 years ago. It's interesting to me as a observer of history and as observer of civil rights movements, as I see parallels between the struggle for African American equality and the struggle for the equality of women, and now the struggle for equality of lesbian and gay men. This is interesting to see how sensitive an issue this is for a church, but it's also interesting to see how this is the second time in 25 years where the church has chosen to go this route of stealth, misleading, let's launder the money through individuals, let's duck and weave. This is very comparable to what happened with the ERA, where people were being bussed under false pretenses and people were being officially told to mask official connections with the church. It was an interesting event. It was, I think, a painful chapter in church history 25 years ago. Most painfully, not because of the church's position on the issue, which I would fight for the right of the church to have a position to take it, but to see them follow this route so insidiously of masking or attempting to mask is troubling. It's also, to me, unlike 25 years ago, doomed to fail. There's no way that the church can hide this kind of involvement today with the kind of scrutiny and the kind of communication that goes on. And I'm puzzled and intrigued to see what will happen in 6 months, because it's the whole situation where the cover-up becomes a story. I think that the church is putting itself in a terrible situation, not because its political position on the issue or its moral issue on the issue is different, but because the method it's choosing to take in California is a troubling precedent. It's a troubling moment in church history, and I think the members of the church should be very concerned to see this happening once again, and the repercussions for all of us inside and outside of the church for the kinds of things it's asking its members to do. Again, I look forward to answering questions, and we'll turn the time over to Bob.
I have some more extended comments that cohere together towards the end, but I've also been kind of assigned to sweep up a lot of random pieces in this whole process. So you'll please forgive me, as I'm trying to get out a lot of information that is not always, it doesn't cohere terribly easily. First, I live in Oregon, and in Oregon we don't have a night initiative just yet, but our state legislature is considering a similar one, so I expect we will probably have a repeat of this story in Oregon in the next couple of months. It's probably easiest to think of my comments now is a supplement to David's chronology, filling in some blanks. What is going on here is a major question. What are the questions, what are the motives of people? And David served as kind of the collector and the provocateur to gather a great deal of information. I gathered different kinds of information. David put his information into the chronology, which Alan read. I put mine into more narrative accounts. We decided that basically the feature should be his chronology today. One of our major problems that we saw in this was what I'll call loosely rumor control. Lots of people talking here and lots of people talking here, but nobody quite knew what was actually happening. So it was to try to, as best we could, to find out what was happening. And we've had reports of things that we felt in the end, the reporters were reliable, but when we'd ask, now what exactly did you ask when you went to this person? What exactly did that person say? And we didn't get clarity coming back, and so that comment kind of went to the side. That yes, there was an exchange there, but we're not quite sure exactly what that exchange was, and so we put it aside. I spoke with one of the area presidents on the telephone, and immediately after the telephone call, I sat down and wrote out my notes, sent him a copy, saying, basically, is this an accurate copy? Did I get everything right? And he kindly wrote back and said everything seemed to be right, except there was one place where he made a correction. It was a correction that I find significant, but a minor one. I'll maybe talk about that in a minute later. Secondly, today I speak very much as a Mormon to a group of Mormons. This is not, I'm not trying to rabble-rouse and go out and carry it beyond the family of the church. First thing, what I want to call the nature of the beast. What exactly do we have here in this chronology or calendar? It's really a tale of two letters. A letter by the area presidency and a letter by the area, now it's Area Authority 70 is the name for it. Now we have a problem. The letter of the area presidency, we have the text, but we have not yet a copy of the text. So the letter we've got, you know, the text you can get on the internet, but we don't have an actual copy anywhere. When it comes to the Area Authority 70's letter, we don't even have a text. We know it has been read. This is the one thing that David forgot to put in his chronology. We have a report of a person who was present when it was read. He says, I remember these were some of the major points, but we don't even have a text to go from, let alone a copy of the text. And people, in fact, now are kind of looking, can we get a text or a copy of it? And so in this whole process of preparing the chronology, if you notice, it's in a way, we're looking at traces of things. This letter was read, well, what are the traces? How did it affect people? So it's more the effects of people who heard this done, who were present, who had things happen to them. Or in one case, we do have a copy of a letter that one person was sent by his stake presidency asking him for money. This was the thing that that affected the question that came up with the elder. Well, it was Elder Samuelson I spoke with. I had used in my summary the word assessment. And he said, "No, it wasn't an assessment. It was suggested amounts." And so the person who wrote gave me this letter, it should be nice to know he was not assessed, but he was suggested that he contribute so much money. Now, I'll jump ahead. This is interesting because this creates a kind of psychodynamics of, I call it, of coercion. Within the church, we're taught that you should follow your leaders, that if there's a problem, the leaders will bear responsibility, you should follow it. Well, if this man comes up to you and says, I think you should give some money, contribute some money to this cause, how do you respond? Now, in this particular letter, it doesn't identify him as a member of the stake presidency, but the first part of the letter sounds very official. It's only in about the last four or five lines it now starts to be very friendly. You're our old friend, and now remember this is purely voluntary, and but you've got that first three or four paragraphs up there that almost verbatim quotations from material distributed. And this creates a certain cycle of to me, a cycle of coercion for it. So this is a real problem trying to, as I say, trying to sort out what really went on or what is really going on in this whole process. It has been said that in one of the publications that much of this material came from gay internet sources or circles, and in fact virtually none of what we know came from gay internet circles. Gay internet circles have been very vocal and, oh, it's terrible, it's terrible, it's terrible, but they've been virtually worthless to find out what's been going on. Virtually worthless. Almost all of our reports that we have seen come from, let's say, straight sources, which I find ironic here. That secondly, it's apparent in the chronology, if you have a chance to read it, in the Family Code of California, it already says marriage is a civil contract between a man and a woman. The only change that this proposes is putting only into the law. Only between a man and a woman. Anything else is out. It's only that, just that word only, that's the only change. And the question that some of us ask is, so what? Why are we going through all this battle over this word only? We're kind of stumped, you know, why is Senator Knight so concerned about it? Why are people in the church leadership concerned about it? It's important, I think Roger mentioned it, this is not a gay battle. This is not a battle that the gay community picked. This is a battle that, in a situation that I think gay people feel they have to respond to. They're not advocating it, we have to respond to it in some way. In relation to this, there's one other thing. I'm firmly convinced, I've become convinced in the last week or two, that this is a war which will be won. Same-sex marriage will be won. We may lose some battles in the process. California might well be a battle lost. But the war will be won on the same-sex marriage side. I don't know when it will be, but it will be won. Then that causes the problems. If people can see the war being lost, why are people fighting what will ultimately be a war which they will lose? And I'm sorry, I can't decide that. I really can't. A lot of, there are old wives' tales that kind of clutter up the grounds here. I'd like to just make a few clarifications that I think are useful. Homosexuality is at base not about sexual behavior. The word homosexual is, the sexual part of it is very ambiguous. I think it starts with the sense of biological sex, male, female. It's not about having sexual behavior. Boyd K. Packer talks about, when he talks about homosexuality, it's always the word lust. Lust, lust, lust. That a man looks at another man and just all goes berserk, and a woman looks at another woman and it goes berserk. Lust. But in fact, the core, I think, of same-sex behavior is really something that is, I like the word being at home. Some years ago, I was asked to edit a group of life stories, and one of the persons talked about he was with someone else, he was married at the time, and that other man took and embraced him. And he spoke about how, for him, it was a kind of a revolutionary awareness. All of a sudden, he was there. He knew what was happening. He'd never had this experience with his wife. They'd been far more intimate. But it was when he was embraced by a man, he had that feeling of completion, of being, in my phrase, at home. Secondly, homosexuality is not contagious. If you look at a lot of, this thing, you know, it'll damage marriages. What happens if the neighbors are a same-sex couple, just living next to them? It's going to damage all the other marriages in the family. Homosexuality is not contagious. At least I've never seen anybody who caught it. And then you have problems, you know. Was it somebody yesterday was saying, you know, why is it I have one son who is gay and all the rest of the kids are not gay? How did he get it? Well, it's not contagious. Secondly, Alan, I think, touched on it. Homosexuality is not something that you get through recruitment. Oh, there may be a sexual experience too that comes from recruitment, but homosexuality does not come from recruitment. At best, the closest that it can come, and this you have to be very careful of, if somebody has this, can we say, desire or orientation or attraction, meeting someone may be a chance for an initial experimentation or exploring of that orientation. But the orientation doesn't come from the recruitment. And this is something I find usually quite hard, and it's a little bit subtle to catch. There's a connection there, but it's not a cause and effect creation. It's more an occasion creation. Now, in politics, appearances are often as important as legalities. And one of the problems that the church has gotten into here is a problem of appearances. In a way, it's like I believe the church has the right to say things, but unfortunately they've chosen a way which is going to be, I think, disastrous. Because the appearance, it gives the appearance of secrecy. Somebody was saying, and I think it was being quoted in one of the letters, that, the Catholic Church just made an announcement, a statement. Yes, well, the Catholic Church made a public announcement, a public declaration that everybody can read. But now, in the Mormon Church, it's being read in the chapels, being read in the meetings, but there's no open letter. As I said, we don't even have a copy of this letter or of these statements that we can point to. And so, because of this, people start to, within the gay community, there's been a great deal of, I'll call it what, worst imaginings, worst case imaginings. People don't know what it is, don't know what is happening, and so they imagine. People don't really quite know what the church goals are to raise money. Somebody had heard the figure $4 million. They sat down and thought, well, let's see, we know that some wards are being asked to raise, or some stakes to raise, $25,000. There happen to be 160 stakes in California. That means $4,000 too. And so we get this cycle of not knowings and worst imaginings. There was one comment in the chronology about somebody being asked to raise, to contribute $250. Well, somebody else was $150. Well, how much is being asked? This is a real, real problem. Now, I'm going to skip to the very end of something. My notes, I'll try to go very quickly, and I'm going to go over time, but I organized the panel, so I have that right, I guess. Paul's going to kill me. It's important, a conceptual problem here when we deal with families is what I will call the difference between family forms and family values. Forms are the kinds of things that I think are very much male-female. Is it one man and one woman? That's a form. Values happen to do, at least in my life, and the way I understand values with, for example, loving, caring, taking care of one another. And these are the kinds of things that somehow get lost in this argument over family values. And we blind ourselves to this distinction only at our greatest peril. We could go here, people think, Don Rascomb, Douglas Callister, the area president, this is a moral issue. But then we also say it's not a litmus test for membership, but yet the actions that they come back to are very, very similar. Now, let me go very briefly about marriage in the family as a moral device. In Genesis, remember, it says, God blessed them, God blessed them and said to them, be faithful and multiply and replenish the earth. Joseph Smith, in that, the responsibility in Genesis is very much, you should be faithful and multiply and replenish the earth. Joseph Smith and Abraham put it somewhat differently, and it's very interesting. And the God said, we will bless them. And the God said, we will cause them to be fruitful and multiply. In Genesis, we as individuals are the responsible party. In Abraham, God is the responsible party. So in a sense, if I don't multiply and replenish the earth, it's not my responsibility. It's his, because he didn't bless me to do that. I think this is something that's very important to remember. We have a reductionism in our sense of sex and marriage, which is very bad. The collapsing of the concepts sex and gender into one, the Proclamation on the Family always talks about gender, it never talks about sex. But in fact, now in the late 20th century, gender and sex refer to things that are very, very different kinds of things. I'll pose one, well, difference here. Harold B. Lee, when he was very old, got remarried. I've forgotten how old he was. This was obviously not a marriage where reproduction was foreseen. That we're getting, you know, when he's, I've forgotten how old he was, I haven't checked on it yet. He was getting married for something else, and that marriage was, the marriage I would suggest, is found in another passage, well, it's in Abraham, it's also in Genesis, and it says, it is not good that man should be alone. It was being married for companionship, not for reproduction. And within the church right now, we're almost always thinking in terms of reproduction, or we're talking in terms of reproduction. And so this suggests that there are other purposes for marriage. I myself have used the phrase loving, caring, empowering, fidelity as being things that hold marriages together, as kind of core values. To me, these are the things which are really moral values. David O. McKay liked the idea of self-discipline as also being important. A family is really created, to me, a moral family as an institution is created when it's created to try to embody these moral values. Is it a loving relationship? Is it a caring relationship? If it isn't these things, it isn't a moral value. Just having kids, that's a biological thing, not a moral thing. We therefore get the kind of irony, for me at least, opposing same-sex marriage strikes me as being the profoundly immoral thing to do. Because what we have here are people, gays and lesbians, who say, I want to be in this type of relationship which will embody these moral values of loving and caring, which will formally and publicly embody these values. It's ironic that the gay and lesbian person who wants to get married wants to live a moral life. And the very opposition to same-sex marriage is in a way saying, no, no, we would prefer that you live a promiscuous life because we're not allowing you to be live a moral life. The irony then becomes that same-sex marriage is being proposed, I would suggest, publicly for moral reasons, but in fact, same-sex marriage is the profoundly moral thing to do. Would you rather, you know, just think for a minute, if you had a son or a daughter, would you rather the son or daughter lived basically a promiscuous life, or would you rather your son or daughter had a stable relationship, a loving relationship, a caring relationship? And these are the exact kinds of relationships which same-sex marriage hopes to embody and to encourage. At this point, open things to questions there for everyone.
Thank you to all the panel members for the wealth of material that they've presented us. We'll move quickly to some questions here. Let me just offer one thought to Robert in his use of Harold B. Lee as an example. There's a more current and more telling example that you can use, and that's Howard W. Hunter, who was much older when he married for a second time than Harold B. Lee was. So put that one in your documentation. Are there any questions that are strictly factual in nature? Some little point that you wanted to make sure you understood exactly what the panelist was saying. If there are any of those kinds of questions, let's take a minute to do those first, right here on the end.
Roger.
Question is, does the full faith and credit clause of the Constitution override any of these attempts by state law? Roger, do you want to address that? We could spend another hour on that.
The answer is we don't know, and the reason we don't know is it's a rarely interpreted clause. So there's the Justice Jackson in the 50s called observed that it was one of the least discussed but most important parts of the Constitution. So the reason there's uncertainty is simply because there's a dearth of situations where it's been applied. Many of us believe it clearly applies to marriage for a couple of reasons. One is because it fits within the text of the kinds of things that are referred to, the official acts of a state in creating that. But the other reason is that the very principle of federalism is this idea that as I drive across the country, as you cross state lines, there should not be uncertainty about what will happen to you if you're hit by lightning as you walk across, and so it's both on the very specific level, but also on the conceptual level. But because there's so little material out there, we're at a situation where we're forced to make analogies which are necessarily incomplete. How is marriage like divorce, and how is it not like divorce? But it's certainly, as I suggested, I believe that the law of the application of how the full faith and credit law should be applied will demonstrate that marriages by a state will be recognized. But because it hasn't been done in the past, we're really in new territory.
Other of a clarifying nature, right here.
One of the things, when the letter was read to the state priesthood, the meeting in our state, and presented by the state president, there were references to other pending legislation in California that would also should be defeated. And as it was presented by the High Council in our particular ward, it was confusing, first of all, because it was not very well informed, but the suggestion was that this would lead to something he called hemophobia and teaching homophobia to elementary school children. My question is, the other legislation in California that is before the legislature that will be on the ballot, what relationship does it have to the marriage?
The question for the tape is, what other legislation pending in California may be affected by this? There appeared to be sort of a parade of horrors argument used in support of people getting behind this amendment, because what it would the impact it might have on other legislation. Is anyone prepared to speak to that? We don't have any California legal people here.
Exactly. I don't know if the reference was to the Safe Schools Act, which was which was defeated in the legislature after the letter. There was a proposal to end discrimination in California schools on the basis of sexual orientation, and it lost by a vote. That wasn't a ballot initiative matter, and so I'm not sure if there's something else. That was a pending law that Sheila Kuehl had advocated, and it failed in the legislature.
Are always accompanied by a series of horror stories. If you don't do this, this will happen.
Right.
There are some places I read, and I'm sorry I can't tell you where, that there were something like three initiatives, gay-related initiatives,
microphone.
And the church was only being involved in one and was not taking any position on the other two, but I'm sorry, I can't find that right now.
The context clearly was, here's a whole plethora of issues, and it's been open to the
Here's one of our internet sources here. Go ahead, Craig.
One of the comments they made in my ward was that there would be forced teaching of the homosexual lifestyle in school if this passed. And they also said that the church would be forced to perform gay marriages if this law passed.
I think Roger could counter that argument pretty well.
No, and
if they didn't perform that,
oh my!
That was also used in Hawaii. The church being forced to perform marriage arguments was that in Hawaii. What was interesting procedurally was the Catholic Church sought to file an amicus, a friend of the court brief in the Hawaii marriage case. The Mormon Church sought to intervene as an actual party in the case on this ground, which is completely preposterous. That as I started my remarks, the idea that civil marriage and religious marriage are certainly very different. The schools question and the forced inculcation of values is a tougher question. As it's stated, it's clearly wrong. The safe schools would not require some sort of affirmative teaching about any particular value. What it would require would be for teachers and students not to be subject to discrimination. There are actually quite a few provisions in California law that already have that effect. This would have given a specific tool, but there's no question that people would be forced to inculcate any particular kind of value other than not hitting people.
Rick.
I wanted to clarify one thing from what Bob said.
other jurisdictions where California
is the change in
other types of marriage that are recognized by California.
In other words, is the change that the Knight Amendment would accomplish merely the insertion of the word only, or does it go further than that? Talk into the microphone. We try to get all this on tape.
Basically adds a new clause to the family code. It doesn't change what's there is already. It says marriage contract. It says marriage contracted outside the state would be valid by the laws of the jurisdiction which the marriage was contracted as valid in that state. But then it adds 308.5 to it. Only marriage between a man and a woman is valid or recognized in California, and it's that only is the. So I'm not the lawyer. I can't take you through all the legal. The code itself, but it's, the difference is you've already got marriage as a man and a woman. It adds only to the clause.
We'll take two more questions, Bill, in the back row, and then right here.
Also, this woman.
If we make them brief, we'll do three. And the lady here has had her hand up, so we'll do those three. And indulge us for a couple of extra minutes. It's 12:41 right now. Some of us have been to law school, and we don't understand tax law either. Ed, maybe you should speak to that.
But I was wondering, if same-sex marriages were allowed across the United States with the full inclusion and whatnot, would the church legally be viewed then as a discriminatory organization and risk the potential of losing their tax-exempt status?
No. But the reason for that is all discrimination laws that prohibit private discrimination have included exemptions for religious organizations, both because the statutes to pass have to have those, but also because the Constitution requires it. The First Amendment guarantee of freedom of religion means that the government cannot tell churches what they should believe or do, and so if a government were to attempt to do that, the ACLU and groups like us would certainly leap in there. I think that there's no danger that the church is going to be getting in trouble for any more than the Catholic Church refusing to ordain women is sex discrimination. It is, but it's not illegal.
The question is, it's not church behavior. It's behavior in a purely political sense. That you're tax-exempt, but tax-exempt organizations are not supposed to involve themselves in politics. The church does, or at least to a certain extent, I think I'm not sure that no involvement or only a significant involvement.
Partisan politics.
It's partisan and partisan.
That's where the loss would be.
Okay. Right here and then back here.
Assuming it is a political question, what is the economic impact of this change in legislation, given the numbers of gay and lesbian, given the impact on 4,000 federal statutes that you guys have done? Is there any legitimate economic study or economic impact statement that's ever been done with respect to this issue?
There are, and they're completely inconclusive. In the Hawaii case, they were trotted out. I mean, it's the sort of thing where you don't know how to frame the question. Some people say, well, what about the greater...